All right, we're going to go ahead and get things started here. We're real excited to be with you. My name is Prejwal Siriam. I'm a co-founder and the managing editor of Partisans Media, and I'm here with a few fantastic people coming in from all around the world, and we're so glad to be here with you in Seattle. Oh, it looks like Seattle, but I think it's Austin. Sorry for the weather. We've got Andrew Gruen coming in here from South Korea. Mary and I just flew in from England, and Shira is from slightly closer in D.C. And we're really excited to be here talking about an issue that I think is incredibly important, the dynamic space of politics online, how it's changing the way that we consume, produce information, and really transform the way that we think about the political process and the process of journalism. And I couldn't think of three better people to be telling you about it than these guys, and a worse person than me to be standing here too, so we'll let them mostly talk. But the most important thing is that we want this to be interactive. We've got a group of people here where I think we can get lots and lots of different voices, different ideas out, so we want to have you engaged. We want you to help us figure out what it is you'd like to hear, and we want to hear a lot of questions from you, so there will be plenty of time for that. Now, when we decided that this would be a fun topic to be out here in Austin talking about, what really came to mind for us was, one, that we've all sort of engaged in politics and journalism from a variety of different perspectives, from traditional news to sort of startup media space. To give you a little bit of background, because you guys will have probably heard a lot more about the places these guys work, Partisans Media is a startup. We got started about a year ago, and what we're trying to do is to build a platform for healthy disagreement. So to get ideas from across the political spectrum, parse the political web, connect great ideas, great writers with the tools they need in order to be able to get their opinions across and to write insightful, exciting, important op-ed material. We've been doing that for about a year at partisans.org. And what we've learned is that the online space is, you know, very exciting because there's so much opportunity for so many different people to participate, but it's wild, right? It's unpredictable, it's unexpected. And given that journalism really is the bedrock of our civil society, you know, you can have votes, you can have politicians, but if you don't have great journalists like these guys, and probably many of you, then there's no way that you have really a healthy functioning discourse. And for the longest time, that discourse has been built on institutions. It's been centralized. It's been focused. It's been in places like The Times and The Guardian and The Journal and these other staid, august organizations. But now we're trying to build this incredibly important aspect of our civil society from the bottom up on complexity. We're trying to build castles on chaos. And that has been terribly confusing and exciting and totally difficult to predict. So I'm hoping that these guys can tell us and tell me a little bit more about how we can predict and how we can understand that very, very rapidly changing space. To my immediate left is Mary O'Hara. Mary, I've known for about a year and some change now. She was a staff writer for The Guardian for 12 years, working on things from news features to social policy in the UK and in the US. She was an Alistair Cook Fulbright Scholar at Berkeley. And in addition to having worked at The Guardian, she's worked at the BBC. She won the award of Mind Journalist of the Year recently. And pretty fun. You should ask her about it after the panel. She just finished her first novel, and I'm sure she'll be excited to tell you what that's all about. Right to the left of Mary, we have Shira Toplitz. Shira works for Roll Call. She used to work for Politico. You might recognize Shira from her many appearances as an analyst on ABC, CBS, PBS, CNN, CNBC, all the letters, MSNBC, Fox. And she's just a fantastic reporter, writer, analyst, everything. And to the left of Shira is Andrew Gruen, who is uncomfortable with me calling him our numbers guy, so I won't call him that, but he may very well be. Andrew is a Gates Cambridge scholar at the University of Cambridge, where he's doing a PhD in sociology, studying news organizations. He's been deeply engaged in looking at the online space, has some experience at the very exciting Oh My News in South Korea, which I'm hoping he'll tell you about, and also the Texas Tribune here in Austin. He's also worked at CNET, BBC, Hearst, just all over the place. And so the way we're going to kick this off with these fantastic folks today is I'm going to ask Mary a question. Mary's going to ask Shira, and Shira's going to ask Andrew. In the meanwhile, I'll ask that you go to partisans.org and vote for the two questions up here that you don't want us to be talking about, and we'll try to talk about the other ones depending on what your results are. And if there are questions that we don't get to that you want to hear about, we'll take them in the question and answer session. But this way, we can hear about what this audience would really like to hear. I'm tremendously excited to get this started. And so Mary has not heard the question that I'm going to ask her. So hopefully she'll be surprised and not think it's stupid. And so Mary, what I'm wondering is, as someone who came into journalism before online journalism became as rampant and important as it is today, do you see the online space more as increasing your reach and your audience and your voice, or do you see it increasing your competition?
Oh, both.
Both. Okay. So, which one is there? One more than the other, or what's the dynamic of that?
Can everyone hear me? Okay. It's hard to know when you're up here if people can hear you. Okay. Good. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned, because I feel like the geriatric on the panel because I'm a bit older than the other guys. But when I started writing for The Guardian, it was right at the very beginning of when it was seemed to be at the cutting edge of journalism on the net. So it was a really interesting time. There was a big warehouse space with three people in it. I mean, that was it. But within about 6 months, it had been absolutely transformed with a huge amount of investment. So we saw it all happen and unfold really, really rapidly. On the editorial floors, there were, we had all age groups on the editorial floors, and people of all ages were struggling in a way to find out how we would use this new technology, how we would use these new platforms to express ourselves and to do better journalism. Fast forward 12, 13 years, and some of the journalism that's being done online is absolutely extraordinary, and I think you'd be hard-pushed to find anyone who started originally in print say that it was in any way not a good thing. What we don't like, I think the single thing that people don't like since this happened is the fact that, and we talked about this earlier, is that when you write an article, the chances of being abused by your readers are pretty high a lot of the time. We had to get used very quickly to people interacting with us in a way that they didn't interact before. Suddenly, print journalists were more visible because people could access us in a way that they couldn't do before. I think it tightened the game. I think it made people focus much more clearly on what they wanted to do. It helped if you were a specialist journalist, because suddenly communities were evolving that you could attach yourself to and that became attached to you. Endless possibilities, I think.
Great. And do you want to go ahead and...
Because Shira is in D.C., and I think if anybody here is interested in, politics as it unfolds there, I'm interested in knowing how Shira feels the journalistic landscape has altered in D.C. in the past few years, because there's lots of talk about niche journalism, about the fact that there are more bureaus now in Washington than there ever were before for reporters from across the world. So I'd be really interested to hear how you think that landscape has altered.
So I think, can everyone hear me now? Yes, great. So I think over the last 10 years in DC journalism, we've kind of seen a lot of different dynamics going on. First of all, we've seen kind of the depletion of the medium-sized newspaper bureau. When I came to Washington, I think I'm from Pennsylvania originally, several papers had DC reporters, and now there's only one paper with the DC reporter, the Allentown Morning Call. So we've seen this happen across the board. At the same time, we've seen the rise of niche journalism. You've seen a lot of, frankly, like Politico, these industry-focused newspapers on the rise, and those have increased. And I think, as a result, we're all still trying to figure out how to be profitable online in many ways. It's a never-ending quest. But in many ways, I'm not always sure it's a good thing, because when a lot of the news coming out of D.C. is industry-focused and is very niche-based. It's very vertical. It kind of increases the echo around each other, and it's more of a bubble, and it's more just Washington bouncing off each other. And rarely do you get the sense of impact of what you're reporting, I think. It's not as often as I think reporters did maybe 10, 20 years ago, really understanding how the issues they're reporting are affecting people. And it's because we are in that bubble. The Pew did a great study a while ago that only 2% of news consumers get their news from Twitter, which is remarkable for me and my colleagues because all we want to do is break news on Twitter right now. And it was eye-opening, I think, for a lot of us to look at that and be like, oh, right, so maybe this doesn't matter that much. So it's my turn to ask a question of Andrew. So over the course of getting to know my co-panelists, I've gotten to know a lot about what they do for a living, and I love hearing about Andrew's travels and some of the newspapers he studied as part of his academic work. So I want to ask you, you've studied these news outlets all over the world. In your mind, which one was the most functional and the healthiest balance of profitability and news delivery?
Well, can everyone hear me? I guess before I start with that, because it's hard, and it's really hard, I'm going to go back and I'm just going to...
I thought I was giving you a softball.
No, I'm just going to go back and I'm going to say we should come back to the point about only 2% of people on Twitter and whether and what matters for online publications. But I guess I'm going to pander because I can, and there's at least one person in the audience that will appreciate the pander. But one of the places that I've been to recently that I really appreciate is the Texas Tribune, which is just down the street. If you haven't gone, you can go and pay homage. It's right along Congress. You can wave. They're on the second floor. They can see you. What I think is really impressive about the Texas Tribune is the plethora of sources that they're drawing their funding from. And actually, when I look at places like Oh My News, they're doing a similar thing, whereas the equation of how you fund quality journalism is becoming more complicated. So there are lots of things that an organization is doing now that raises a lot of money for the kinds of reporting that was once paid for in a simpler situation where you had subscribers paying for basically enough to buy the newsprint and deliver it to the plant, and then you had advertisers paying for everything else. So if you look at something like the Tribune, one of the really great things that they do as a nonprofit is they're collecting grants, and grants help them do big projects that are really useful for their audience, and they do other things like events, large events. For people on multiple tracks, I mean, not as big as South by Southwest, but maybe one day. And you know, if you look at Oh My News, they're doing very much the same. So it's this cornucopia of places that are using lots of creative ways to generate revenue. And in Oh My News, one of their biggest events happens at their school, you know, which is not traditionally the way you would think about what a journalism organization is doing. But yeah, I guess to be a bit general, it's not one place, but it's the fact that places are collecting lots of different kinds of revenue from many places.
Fantastic. Well, I think we basically hit all of the possible topics in those few questions. We've got some, and I hope that we'll be able to return to a lot of what these guys said then, everything from the ways that places like the Texas Tribune have been designing their business model to the changing roles of journalists in this space. But let's find out what you want to hear. So let's see here. Is this going to tell me? Okay. Well, it seems like the first thing you guys don't want to hear quite as much, the first thing you guys don't want to hear quite as much is about how to make money, so we won't talk about that.
I'm off the
hook. Some people like to make
money.
I'm off
the hook.
I don't know. And you also don't want to know what a journalist is, so maybe we won't return to either of the questions I mentioned. That's okay. We'll hit the other ones. What I'd love to do is, by the way, if you have questions as we're going along and you're afraid they're going to fly out of your head, most things fly out of my head real quick, feel free to send the question via Twitter using the hashtag SXPartisans. My colleague Alex Hudson is going to be here collecting those and passing them on to me, and so we'll get your ideas in the flow as we're going along, so feel free to do that. So let's start with... Let's start with the thing that's at the bottom of this list. How do we parse the political web to provide readers with the news they want, and should we care what they need as well when we do that? Now, maybe a great place that was something I'm very curious about is that perhaps the biggest guy in town as far as parsing news and politics online, well, maybe it's debatable, but it could be Facebook, right? Because you get a distribution of what your friends are reading, what they think. And when you guys produce news, is that in your picture, how that's going to get distributed through Facebook? What strategies for content sharing there impact the process in the newsroom itself?
So I'll start. So when I write a story, in general, I don't try to think about this is going to get me a lot of hits. I try not to do that. I don't think it's healthy for journalism. I don't. I try not to do that. I know, but there is. It's well known in the newsroom. If you write a story about Ron Paul, your story's going to be number one on the most read list on your website for a while. So I think a lot of journalists might have that in the back of their head. I try and approach it this way. I think, I write my story. I write what my editor asks me to. I write what I think our subscribers might be interested in. And keep in mind, because Roll Call is a subscription-based publication, I think we're a little different than, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or something like that. So I write that, and then I think the next step, after I've written my story, it's been published, I try and implement more in the marketing of it. The whole idea of you have to market your stories. I can't imagine what it was like to be a print journalist 10 years ago and not have to flack your own stuff all the frickin' time. But that's what we do now as journalists. I think of and how I can tweet this out in a certain way to get eyeballs on it. And part of that is Facebook. I think more of my colleagues read my stories through Facebook than on the Roll Call website. Very possible. Or it's because I emailed them and I got it in their inbox. So I don't know if I quite answered your question.
I know, yeah, I think absolutely. One thing that comes to mind then is the extent to which Oh My News depends on this. So Oh My News, you can tell us a little bit about it, but it's driven by citizen journalism, right?
Right. Well, Oh My News, just really briefly, is I think still the world's largest citizen journalism organization. They have about 88 staff members, and over their history, they've had almost 70,000 citizen journalists contribute, but that's about a little bit north of 3,000 people contributing per year, about 150 stories a day. So now that we have that out. But I think as far as figuring out what people want, having people actually writing the stories they want to write is obviously helpful and obviously useful. But I think Oh My News is grappling with this question of providing what people want and actually getting it out to readers, particularly through a Facebook style, through Facebook and Twitter and a couple of other smaller Korean social networks, in exactly the same way that more traditional news organizations are trying to grapple. They within the last year hired their first social media editor whose job it is to try to actually funnel all of the different citizen content and get it to the right places on the web so that people who are interested can know about it. But I guess the other thing that I wanted to add was stepping a little bit back of the question is about what I viewed the question as what people want and figuring that out even more than maybe the delivery mechanism being Facebook. And I think that's maybe super, even more critical than it was ever before because we have so much, if not infinite choice, that as much as you may not like it, that you need to think, I would contend you have to think about getting a lot of hits because, of course, if you don't, what's the point of doing it? You have to, I think, increasingly consider what do people want and giving them precisely what they want. And I actually was going to say, I think you may even have an easier job of that because of a place like Roll Call. You may have not just subscription, but I would guess, and I don't know, you probably have a picture in your head of the audience that you write for.
And we have data on them. But, the flip side of giving readers what they want is like the full news candy diet. What readers want to read, and, you can look on popular news websites and look at the most read stories. They want to read about Sarah Palin and Lindsay Lohan. That's not a healthy news diet. Now, whether or not I should or my colleagues should be the ones that decide what kind of healthy news diet is for you, I don't believe that either, but I do think we shouldn't be. No news organization should be focused solely on writing stories for the primary reason of just getting clicks. Like, that should not be your editorial mission solely.
Well, Mary, we're just talking about the Sun.
I think this kind of goes to the heart of a lot of the debates that, you know, that are happening within the news industry at the moment. Whether you're in newspapers, whether you're in exclusively online media, whether you're niche, whether you're mainstream, it's an absolutely crucial issue. When the whole concept of citizen journalism began to emerge, there was a real complex among a lot of professional journalists because they began to feel that they were being devalued and undermined, as opposed to being supplemented and added to by people who have perhaps more knowledge than they do in many ways. But I think that I agree with Shira on that. If you completely governed what you write by how many people are going to read it, you'd probably never write the stuff that you really want to write. And it's finding that balance between delivering what your audience want. But ultimately, your job as a journalist is to inform them about things that maybe they didn't know they wanted to know about as well. And sometimes that journalists get accused of being extremely arrogant for that. But actually, that's ultimately what we get paid for, or maybe don't get paid for anymore. But
get paid poorly for it.
But I think, and I genuinely think that we're still in an extraordinary period of adjustment. We haven't quite figured out what our balance should be. We haven't quite figured out how much we should react. So I think maybe in the next sort of 2 to 3 years there'll be a sort of codification of that. We'll begin to grasp it a bit more. Journalists will be more comfortable with it. But I certainly don't think that we should be chasing hits. And I've worked for a newspaper that before the internet didn't have a mass circulation. And if we had constantly chased that, we never would have got it. You know, I wasn't going to write about celebrities, no matter how much people wanted to read about them. I might read about them somewhere else, but I'm not going to write about them. You know.
Can I give an example? I mean, I've worked at one news organization where I was instructed to write a story because it was, quote, drudge bait, unquote. And does everyone know what I mean by that? Mm. Okay, good. All right. That's the thing I think we need to be very careful of. It's a fine line, but we should be really careful of that because that's not the reason to write a story.
Well, that may not be the reason to write the story, but I think there is still something to be said for writing something that people desperately want and need in their lives as they get increasingly busy. And one of the things that I just think is interesting listening to the two of you talk is that it seems almost inside out, so like inside of you and inside the news organization out to the audience, as opposed to what does the audience want and what does the audience need and how can I serve the audience and how can I do things for them.
I would disagree with that, and if that's the interpretation of what I said, then perhaps I didn't explain it properly, because I think that the adjustment that's being made right now is that very adjustment. So the use of Twitter to promote your stories, the asking people to give you feedback and actually canvassing for stories. I mean, I have found some great stories by putting a question on Twitter and saying, okay, guys, this is what I'm looking into. Who knows shit about this? Can you tell me something? And suddenly you get bombarded with stuff. And so they lead me in a direction with a story that perhaps I wasn't going to go. And you get a real sense of what's topical, of what people are really passionate about. And I genuinely think that even though mainstream news takes a lot of flack for not engaging with it, actually I think they're quite passionately engaging with it. But what you don't want to do is get so carried away with that that you lose track of why you're there in the first place.
Now, one thing that I think is coming out of this discussion is the idea of journalists, the individuals, as these parsers of the political web, making these decisions and filters on what is valuable, what they think readers want. Do you think that I could just replace you with an algorithm that Google writes to do that same job?
Oh, yeah, we're all totally useless. We don't do anything functional at all. No.
I mean, this is like a stupid, it sounds like a punny question to ask, but the fact of the matter is I think a lot of the stuff that human beings write right now will be written by algorithms, and hopefully the approach that you take is to take that commodity stuff and you don't do it anymore. And then the reporters, the human beings, get to go and make the stories better. One of my favorite not so little pieces of technology recently is a company at Northwestern called Narrative Science, where they literally take all the history of all baseball statistics from the beginning of the time that they were recorded to today, and they plug in the stats from a given game, and in 20 seconds, they have a complete story written about the game that's pretty decent. So instead of a reporter sitting in the press box taking, even if it only took him or her 10 minutes to write the story, that's still 10 minutes right after the game that the reporter can be down on the field actually asking questions and doing the things that only the reporters can do. So, I mean, I would be less flippant with the question because I think it's real. I guess.
Well, and so I'm gonna pull in a question we've got already from the audience from, I hope I don't embarrass you, Josh Belsman out there wants to know what responsibility, and I think it connects, what responsibility do reporters have to stick around and moderate or further discussions their pieces generate?
Oh, that's a good question.
We get asked that. I get asked that a lot by editors. Do you guys get asked that by editors, or we often get asked that?
And how do you feel about doing it?
If a discussion has started, it's common practice now. I think yeah. it's common practice for journalists to directly engage after they've written the story. I think one of the difficulties is usually you're working on three things at once, so it's more about finding the time to mm-hmm. engage with people in a meaningful way. So sometimes the readers might think you don't want to engage with them, but actually you're already started on your next thing. But it's actively encouraged, and certainly almost everyone I know who writes does at some level do that.
And do you think it makes your job more rewarding?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes. I think it's great. And then I often get a good follow-up story idea from it, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good for it. Like, usually it's on Twitter. I'll, you know, tweet out my story, and then I'll get responses, and you start a discussion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes someone will tweak me, and then, you know, I'll respond back in kind. But I think it's really valuable and rewarding. I try to do it whenever I can. The Washington Post does a really good job of when they put together a nice package story, usually about a social trend. They'll have a chat or a conversation afterwards. They do a really good job with that.
One of the other things that I really like, and this is a small piece of technology, again, that's great. I don't know how many of you read The Verge, the technology news site. Some of us, maybe. But their story streams. Are you familiar with this? They link together all their stories about a particular topic so that you as a reader, if you're coming to it an hour or 2 hours or 5 days later, you can go through it and see that whole stream, which I think is also a way of, you know, technology, I think, will help to do this.
Do that,
And I think it helped to do it better because, of course, you have limited time and you can't spend all of your time following up on your story. Otherwise, you'd never write a new one. But that's actually a nice way of helping that process to happen by seeing the progression and seeing, because the comments then come along with those as well.
I think it's a really exciting development that you don't produce a piece of work that then just disappears into the ether. Mm-hmm. That actually it has a life beyond you. And sometimes people get into really great discussions among themselves, and they're not interested in you anymore. They're interested in what they have to bring to it. But equally, the fact that I sort of see if you produce a piece of work, it's got like maybe 10 different layers that it didn't have a few years ago. So you will have links through to stories in other places. You will have links through to deep data on the subject, to historical articles on it, to things that other people have done. So when a user or a reader goes in, they get a multi-level experience that they wouldn't have had before. And they get that well after the journalist has moved on. I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting things that's happened.
And do you think that... So what's the downside of it? Because it sounds great.
You get a load of abuse.
Yeah.
You do.
From people who don't have names or faces. Yeah. Like, I put my name on my stories. Who are you?
Yeah. I think a lot of journalists get aggravated by that.
So annoying.
And when you talk about ideologies and what you get, you know, because if you write for what is classified as a left-leaning or a right-leaning publication, then you can be guaranteed that there are plenty of trolls on there just waiting mm-hmm. to have a go. And in many ways, they've prejudged you. And it doesn't have to be a left or right thing either. I mean, is anybody here from Britain or Ireland? Right. So you'll kind of be familiar with a name like mine coming from Ireland. My name, Mary O'Hara, is a Catholic name. So I write a piece about sectarianism in Northern Ireland, and before anyone has blinked, I will get the comments calling me a Fenian bastard or something, because they assume that because of my name that I must be prejudiced in some way on that issue. That is a big downside, because they're not looking at the work for the work. They're assuming that I have a political agenda that I don't have.
So then when you're trying to be an...
And excuse my swearing. Sorry.
And it's not,
Mary.
Not a common experience. I mean, my name is Shira Tuplitz, as you know. It sounds very Jewish. Shira is a Hebrew name. My father was Israeli, and I get all kinds of... You know, it happens. I get anti-Semitic tweets at me. Like, it just happens. People will send me emails. That still happens.
That's the downside, I would say, more than anything. The rest of it's pretty good.
So then, is it, as you try to be honest and objective and balanced journalists, given that people are going to be, in many ways, your name is one example, but I'm sure there are a number of examples, people are going to be coming in with preconceived notions about the organization you're working for, about your name, about whatever, is it even possible to have objectivity in journalism? Broad question, but I just came to mind.
Andrew, you should take this one.
Right.
And answer it and solve it so no one ever has to ask it again.
Yeah, give us an algorithm.
What's the algorithm say?
Yeah. No. I mean, I think objectivity is maybe impossible in the real world. Everyone has their perspective. But I think a different question that is related but slightly easier to answer is, are we sure we want only objectivity? Are we sure that objectivity is always the goal? And are we sure that not understanding someone's point of view and accepting it and then still reading that can be useful? And I think the UK, and maybe Mary, you can tell us a little bit more, but the UK newspaper environment is interesting in that way, wherein newspapers have a definite perspective. And you know when you read something in one paper or the other that is coming from a particular point of view. And you know, I don't think you would... Maybe you would claim that that destroys the UK news environment, but I probably wouldn't.
No, I just think the cultures in the two countries are quite different. The newsrooms have developed differently. And so when the furore happened here around, you know, shoot newspapers, be truth-telling, you know, I think most people balked at that. I think most people thought that was rather strange. But you can still, I suppose, think you're telling the truth, but you're telling the truth from a particular perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get tied up in all kinds of philosophical debates mm-hmm. around this. I mean, I think ultimately what it comes down to is if you're a reporter and you're trying to do the very best job that you can do, then you're trying to find the truth in any story and tell it as best you can with the facts that you have available. Now, that's the ideal scenario, but we know that in reality, in a lot of newsrooms, there are... political pressures on people to tell a story a certain way. In Britain, it's probably tabloid culture that is mm-hmm. among the worst offenders of that. And anyone who's been following the Leveson inquiry and the extraordinary breach of ethics in journalism that has been happening.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, if you don't know about what happened, I mean, hands up if you've heard of the phone hacking scandal, because it's linked to Rupert Murdoch, etc. So a lot of you know about it. I won't waffle on about it. But it kind of really goes at the heart of the ethics of journalism. It's not just about objectivity or balance. It's about, you know, are you going in with such an extreme agenda, using such extreme methods, that you're actually undermining the job of journalism, you're undermining your profession. And what has come out from this inquiry is an extraordinary litany of poor practice, of illegal practice, of collusion with different public agencies. I mean, it's been an extraordinary 6 months in British journalism, perhaps the most extraordinary in 100 years. And it's really pulled all of this to the fore. But it was journalists who exposed the malpractices of journalists, so we have to be very careful not to tar everyone with the same brush and things like that. But I was reading a piece recently by, and it's linked to Leveson, but by a British tabloid journalist who was trying to explain what it was like for him in a newsroom, you know, what kind of pressure he was under. And he says, everything I wrote was designed to appeal to the emotional over the rational, the knee-jerk over considered, assumptions reinforced rather than challenged, and all presented in an easily digestible style that celebrated its own triviality. I mean, and this guy, he's saying this, you know, he's bearing witness to that's the nature of the journalism that he did. So I think we should all aspire to be as balanced and as objective as we possibly can, because frankly, that's the extremities if we don't.
Well, but maybe there's another access of extreme, and I guess that's kind of what I was wondering is... Mm. Sometimes, in particularly in some domains of news, might you want the opinion of someone who spends their days following what's going on in this particular area? Might you want to know the opinion of what someone who spends their days doing this? I mean, I can think of areas that I might want to know that opinion. Mm. But that's where I wonder if objectivity is really, at least in the United States, do we really want it all the time, or is it something we say we want?
I helped to run a company called Partisan, so I'm on board with you there. So do we think that that it's opinions that sharply disagree with each other from which truth somehow emerges, or the real backbone for that truth?
And suddenly, I feel like I'm back in graduate school, Pranjal.
Huh?
I feel like I'm in graduate school again. Where do ideas come from?
Okay. So, see, I'm the one who's going to be the academic here, not you. As far as the characteristic of the panel, or do we really need the people who say no? I'm not going to have an opinion. I'm going to be objective.
So I think if you have a partisan news source out there, if it exists, people will read it, and partisans will go to it. You know, it's just going to be there. You can use the example of the Daily Caller in D.C., which does not like to be called a conservative publication, but, you know, if you look at their headlines, it's obvious that, you know, some of their stuff leans to the right. And I think if it, you know, like that Nietzsche quote, you know, if it weren't there, it would, you know, it would create itself. So I think it's going to be there. You kind of just have to acknowledge its existence. But I can tell you that it's hard to take them seriously. And reporters I know who've worked there have a hard time getting their phone calls returned.
Mm. Yeah.
So I want to put you
from
guys,
sources, I should clarify.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, clarify.
You know, I want to jump a little bit because another one of our audience members wants to put you on the spot a little bit. I think this is intended to put you on the spot. So I'm going to maybe not get this name entirely right, but Pernille Tranberg asks you guys, name three competencies that distinguish you from citizen journalists.
Three
competencies. So what are the skills that you have that make you better than citizen journalist?
I'm looking forward to the actual reporters.
No, but I think
you used to be a reporter.
I get to bail.
I think skills is. I think it's probably more of a sort of collection of things rather than three sort of skill sets or something.
So go with it, however you want to answer it.
No, I do it because I think that, I mean, for instance, one of the things that is really important to me as a reporter is that I'm guided very specifically by certain regulations, by certain codes of practice, by certain ethics that I feel I have to follow. And years on the beat in different types of journalism really drum that home to you. You enter a story very carefully. Some of the subjects that I work on, I talk to a lot of vulnerable people, very vulnerable people, and I really do feel like it took years of experience and training and guidance from editors who had a lot of experience themselves on how to deal with that and how to tell those stories sensitively and how not to upset the people that I'm speaking to. I think that's really, really important. So I'd say that citizen journalists probably don't have that kind of architecture behind them. They may dip in and out, so that can mean that they're not sort of wholly doing this all the time. And I do think that whether you're a software engineer, you know, whether you're an artist, the more you're doing something, the more immersed you are in it, hopefully the better you get at doing it. And one of the strange things that's happened in the past 15 years is the proliferation of journalism courses and journalism schools, and I think in many ways that's a good thing, that people go through those courses, that they look at the ethics, they look at the morals, and then they get experience in various different newsrooms, and I just think that's really important that you have that. And then if you get into trouble, you have organizations behind you to help you, because we get into trouble.
So I'm definitely going to agree with Mary on the matter of ethics. I won't speak to the ethics of every citizen journalist. I'm not here to attack that in general, but there is a standard code of ethics and professional conduct in my industry, and if I don't adhere to it, I will get fired, I'll get hung out to dry, it won't work. So ethics, number one. Number two, assuming the citizen journalist, this is not how they get paid, because otherwise they're not a citizen journalist, they're a professional journalist. This is my full-time job. I can dedicate this from 7 a.m. to midnight every day, and as a result, I think I have a knowledge base and very of-the-moment expertise when this is your job, this is what I do every day. And third, I strongly believe in this, editorial oversight. I have a boss above me that looks over my work and a boss above her that looks over my work. And there's something to be said about having three sets of eyes or three different opinions on something before it's released out to the public as one of the best, the closest version of the truth that you could manage in before your deadline.
I guess I feel like I should just explode the definition of what citizen journalists do a little bit because I can, and I, you know, Oh My News, a lot of these things are interesting because we have these people who we think are citizen journalists, but people who write for Oh My News are automatically paid for every story they do. And the automatic payment is very low. The maximum payment you can receive is about $40. But they're also given tips. So other citizens read a story, decide it's something they're interested in and that they like, and they get tips, and these tips have reached astronomical levels. I mean, it's not unheard of to have a tip of something like 20 million won, which is, I don't know, about $15,000, $16,000 on a single story. And the other idea that citizen journalists don't ever have editors, I just want to blow this up too, because at Oh My News there's an editorial staff of almost 20, and every single story that comes in the door is seen by at least one pair of eyes, if not if it makes it up to the top of the homepage, it's seen by three or four.
Haven't you shifted?
They're getting paid for the full-time job. How are they not professional journalists?
Well, I mean, these people also do other things.
Go to journalism school? I didn't go to journalism school.
Well, but I mean, these people are doing other things with their lives and dipping into the world of journalism when it's relevant to them. So I think it's not that your definition is totally wrong or what you were saying was totally wrong at all. I think it's easy to think about citizen journalists as a specific way, and it's not always that way.
So do you see Oh My News as professionalizing citizen journalism?
We have someone who's really anxious for a question, but they do have an ethical code, I don't think it's actually been translated in English, but I mean the fundamental principle of the ethical code of Oh My News is truth. So the fundamental principle of what editors are actually checking for is fact checking and truth telling.
But I think that's where the line, and this is, sort of goes back to saying that we had the dust hasn't quite settled on this, because I think Shira has a really good point. I think it's sort of blurring, and I don't think any of us have really figured out where that blurring starts and ends. Because from your description, I would say, well, these are part-time professional journalists.
Yeah. These are freelancers.
As opposed to full-time professional journalists. And so I think, you know, kudos to them, because they're obviously doing fantastic things. And I think it would be a really disingenuous reporter who in any way tried to say that these people were any less than a valuable asset to the ecosystem. But I also think that we can get sometimes carried away with what we think is new necessarily, but isn't. And, you know, down the years, people have always contacted news organizations. They've always fed into them. You know, you simply wouldn't be here with a story if people didn't ring you up and tell you that there was something. They just find different ways to tell you and different ways to take part. And I think it's a wonderful thing.
So a big part of the definition that keeps coming up in trying to figure out what a journalist is here seems to be that ethical code. And so Victor Balta wants to know, and we were talking about balance before, which I think builds into this. So when we're talking about balance, when we're talking about the ethics of objectivity and about being a journalist, can you serve that simply by quoting someone from both sides, or do you have a responsibility to figure out what's right? And does a citizen journalist have that responsibility as well, I wonder?
How many people have read the post about truth vigilantes in the New York Times? Just as a yes, so some of us.
A few people.
Okay.
Someone should give a background, because we talked about this a lot in our pre-panel.
Yeah.
Well, I guess just to very quickly summarize, the public editor of the New York Times wrote a post asking whether or not the New York Times should be truth vigilantes.
Worth a Google.
It's very worth it. You should stop paying attention to me talking right now and just go read
just
it.
Yeah, you guys just get on out here. I'm going to read it too.
Read the comments after it.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a really, really brilliant follow-up piece in Vanity Fair where they just ripped the guy to shreds. I mean, I think there was actually there is some validity to his statement. You know, how much is it the job of a journalist to check into every single thing that someone says and decide, how much is the journalist's job to decide whether or not it is truth? But the background of I think what everyone will launch into now is just that there was this very public, open debate about whether or not it was really the job of journalists to be seeking out and determining the truth of every statement that they then quote.
And Arthur Brisbane's piece, as in his capacity as ombudsman, was triggered because of the Republican primaries and because of statements that were being repeatedly said about President Obama. The argument was that the journalists knew that this wasn't true. If they knew that it wasn't true that President Obama had said what was being repeated on the campaign trail as having said, don't they have a duty just not to reprint it as if it's truth? Don't they have what he was asking is, don't they have a duty to say, actually, never
a parenthetical statement. Actually, Mitt Romney was paraphrasing this thing out of context that the president said 2 years ago.
Yeah, and so there was a whole hoo-ha then about whether or not you can actually leverage into a news story every piece of analysis saying whether or not what someone said was true.
So if we can operate under the assumption that this is a good idea, newspapers and news people should be truth vigilantes, that this is what we're supposed to do, if we just make that assumption, my question is, can partisan journalists effectively do that too? If you're a partisan journalist, is that possible?
You can be partisan and still, you know, have a responsibility towards fact, right? And loyalty towards fact.
But I think the spectrum comes into this very importantly, because we talk about partisanship or ideological bends, but actually they are a spectrum, and there are extremes of these. And I think where we run into real danger is where someone approaches a story, decides to write something, haven't already decided, like, full stop, what their ideological approach is, and in doing that, do not take into account any other viewpoints, are stubbornly unwilling to hear what other people have to say, and have closed their minds. I mean, I think it's one of the most damaging things anybody could have, never mind a journalist, that your mind is so closed that you start from that point always, and you never let yourself be open to change.
So I want to make sure that all of you guys get a chance to ask questions if you haven't done it digitally already. But before I do, the one last thing in 30 seconds, I want you guys to get your crystal balls out and predict where the online landscape is going to go. In particular, are we going to continue to get this fragmentation and proliferation, or is retrenchment going to start and people are going to start to consolidate?
I think it's not an or. I think it's an and question. I think both things will happen. If you look at the numbers, the largest news sites on the web in the United States are the biggest brands that everyone knows. Yahoo News, CNN is huge, The New York Times is huge, The Huffington Post is huge. These are big brands, and that's where most people get their news. But that doesn't mean that there won't be a complete fragmentation of the next step down. We will see lots of experiments and a complete shotgunning and people throwing crap against the wall and seeing what sticks. So I think the idea that there will be or is not right. I think both things will happen.
Sure. I hope we consolidate, because I think good reporting is often expensive reporting and time-consuming reporting. And I think news organizations should do this kind of stuff. It's not cheap to send someone on the presidential campaign for months at a time, or stick them in Iowa for 6 months. And I think it's important. I think it's also important to hire knowledgeable reporters who've been there much longer, in the business much longer than I've been in the business. I think institutional knowledge is really valuable. So I hope they consolidate, because I think the outcome would be better.
I think we're lucky to have a disparate media. I think we're very fortunate to have lots of different viewpoints out there, lots of different sources of news, lots of different channels of news. Bring it on, right? Bring it on. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think what would be problematic is if that became the dominant theme of that ecosystem, is that we would lose some of the most valuable things that we have. And I think one of the biggest issues that has yet to be resolved, and hopefully will be in the next few years, is the structural crisis with newspapers. And we still call them newspapers because they physically print stuff, but essentially they're online products, and all of their strategies are based around their online strategies and how the hell they're going to make some money. And I genuinely think that in order to guarantee the best quality journalism that we can, they need to find a way to make sure that those big organizations that have done this work day in, day out, continue to do it.
Great. Well, thanks for looking into the crystal balls and giving us every different possible permutation of the answer. And
three different crystal balls.
Right? Yeah, well, fair enough. And I'd love to turn it over to you. So if you've got a question, come on up to the main mic that's right here. Tell us who you are and go ahead and ask your question. And will our panelists do their best?
I'm Gabi Shafson. I'm a grad student at MassArt in Boston. What do you guys think about Jay Rosen's idea of the view from nowhere, right, where journalists should take a slant but just provide a disclaimer when they do so, and kind of let consumers decide how they want to consume that?
So I think parenthetical disclosures are important. I think it's, you know, if you – I'll give an example. There's a very high-ranking TV journalist who covered a Senate race in a couple years ago, and his wife was working on that Senate race. I think that is important information that the viewer or the reader should know. And that qualification was always made when this person was on air, when this person wrote, and made it very clear whenever he discussed it. So I think that's important, but it's a slippery slope, because if you take the time to put it in the, you know, at the end of the column or whatever, that kind of slant, I think readers read into it way more than they should sometimes. And I think, especially if it's still a novelty when people do it, I think readers read too much into it. I think it would take certainly an adjustment period of readers to understand that, you know, this person may have a wife or maybe work, this is my bias, but it's not the end of the world. You could, you know, my article's still credible. It would take some adjustment, I think.
I mean, I think the view from nowhere is certainly a problem. I guess I would agree with Rosen, and particularly I think this actually ties in with the truth vigilantes bit that we had before, which is that stories. I don't necessarily personally have a problem if a story is setting out from a particular perspective, as long as it's in search of the truth. So if you have a story that is there's a series of events and you're out to explain that this is you are coming from a position but you're going to the truth, I think you're in a much better place, and I think that's kind of at the heart of what journalism is supposed to be. So I would agree with Rosen. I think the view from nowhere is really dangerous, but I think it's slightly different than disclosures. Maybe it's that that you know, a story might be coming from a particular place, from a particular perspective, and even a journalist might be. But I think the direction, I guess if that's a metaphor that works, the direction that they're going is important too.
I remember being asked by an American in an interview a few years ago about my view on advocacy journalism as an advocacy journalist who was going to be in the U.S. where that isn't necessarily part of the culture, because I make no bones about the fact that the issues that I'm interested in are specific issues. I'm interested in poverty, I'm interested in prisons, I'm interested in when people fall through the net. That's my starting point. And I think anyone who reads my work knows that those are the issues that I'm interested in. What about hope anybody who reads it gets is not me setting out with a mission to tell a particular story in a particular way about those subjects, but that I'm upfront about those being the subjects and the areas that I'm interested in. And if someone tried to tell me that poverty didn't exist, I'd probably freak out.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in real quick on this one too, even though I'm the moderator, and say that I think it's the opinion journalism and the idea of being upfront about your opinion plays an incredibly important part in the ecosystem, and that there is a difference between having an opinion and being dishonest, right? And so you can reinforce honesty, and you can reinforce a commitment to facts while knowing that the person is making a really, really clear argument. It's something we struggle with a lot. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure that we can be loyal to our contributors in the sense that they get their opinions across, but make sure that they're doing it in a way that is respectful to the reader and the idea of being straightforward?
Yeah, but writing vacuous opinion is so irritating because there's a lot of vacuous opinion out there. Opinion has a place when it's well-researched, when people are making a lucid argument, that they've really reached a point, they've gone on a journey to reach a point, as opposed to started at the point and went out and just found the things that, you know, reinforce it.
Absolutely. We hope that people do this, right?
So in general, I love social media for this kind of disclosure because, you know, you don't have to make... Let's say you have a very loose connection, like you're an expert on such and such, or you spent, you know, 20 years in Taiwan studying this. Like, you don't have to put it in your column necessarily. You don't have to make the column about you and your experience. You just put it on your Twitter profile, and people can find it. And it's easy, and it's not a big deal.
Absolutely. This gentleman's been standing here for a while.
Please ask a good question. We just get carried away.
And it's kind of on a related note, on the issue of truth vigilantes. I'm interested... and your thoughts on what role your readers and the public in general have in researching fact. I guess I'm thinking of I forget if it was The Guardian who did the big PM expenses scandal, and, you know, turning that paperwork and thousands of documents over to readers and having them ferret out suspicious items.
It's turned out to be astonishingly fantastic because, I mean, one of the things we all know is that newsrooms are under more pressure, you know, cuts are being made, staff are being laid off. That's the reality of it. Yet you've got a whole pool of people out there, accountants, lawyers, doesn't matter what their profession is, they know stuff that we don't know. They do that day in, day out. And one of the things that The Guardian has done with different stories is literally put the documents online and say, are you an engineer? Are you a chartered accountant? Are you this? Can you tell us what this means? And you will get an enormous response from, like, professional people telling you what to look for, how to find it, and then the journalist takes the information, takes the data, and tries to do something with it. I think it's a fantastic development, and, you know, the more people that are doing it, the better.
New York. It's just the follow-up. Is that, I mean, how scalable is that? That must have been a huge undertaking, and was the lesson, hey, this is great, but we got to pick our spots, or it's like, no, let's do it with
it. you know what I'm saying about this layering of the way we work? I think you've got to look at the resource that you've got and use it as best you can. And on some bigger stories where really you know, you're trying to unpick or unravel something very complex, that kind of thing works fantastically. It isn't going to work for every story, but for those that it does, it's great.
It worked well for the Palin papers. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. That was brilliant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So smart.
It's knowing when those things are really going to come into their own.
I guess on the Palin papers, though, you might argue some of that was dredge bait in the motivations for sending people up. It's like, oh, she's a polarizing figure. Let's see what we can find. You know, it kind of cuts both ways.
I mean, she was an elected official. This was a big, long-time legal battle over whether or not she would release these emails. She used, I think, a different email address or stuff. I think this was a controversial issue worth going through, and I'm glad, you know, people were willing to look at, you know, all, what was it, 2,700 pages of it or whatever. And I think it was newsworthy. Like, I think that Drudge likes to link to stuff about Palin, but I also think it was newsworthy.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to ask you, Andrew Gruen, what percentage of traditional journalistic staff do you think will be replaced by citizen journalism, automatic software, experts blogging, having a really great audience, and do you have any?
I don't know that I'd want to guess a percentage, but I think if you think about the way that news organizations are put together right now, they have been staffed up for the peak, right? You have all the people available so that you can cover the biggest events that are going to happen, a hurricane or whatever. And I think what will happen is that they will become a much smaller core with lots of different tentacles. And you can already kind of see some of this happen. I mean, Oh My News is an extreme of this. But what I think will happen is you'll have this really kind of very strong editorial core, and you'll have layers of other kinds of interactions. So you'll have a layer of experts who are, you know, these kind of part-time independent journalists who really know about a particular subject. And when you need a story about that particular subject, you'll have a group of people you can call, and you'll get that story, not unlike magazines operate today. And then I think you'll also have people in that core who are expert at working with citizens and knowing when to reach into the citizen journalism pool and how to interact with them and how to edit with them. And I think you'll also have people in that core who reach even farther and who are good at collecting up information and stories that you need from social media and from other, you know, what we used to call user-generated content. So I wouldn't say a percentage, but I think it's going to become a much more flexible kind of organization.
I agree. I think the single biggest cost to any news organization is people, is paying salaries.
Well, digital ones.
Yeah. But actually, British newspapers, they would say the same thing. They'd say their single biggest cost, paper, big cost, but actually paying people livable salaries is an incredible cost base. And I genuinely think that some kind of version of that is what will emerge in the next 5 to 10 years. Core editorial staffs, regular freelancers, reliable people who you go to, the editors go to a lot to produce copy. They can't, unless they suddenly magically find new money, they can't survive in the model that they're currently in. And that could be a workable alternative. And I think it'll be really interesting to see
the difficulty with this model, and what we have to figure out is how to support those freelancers in a different way.
Yeah.
And you know, there aren't things like guilds for journalists where you do have that in maybe the film industry. And so that's something that we haven't figured out yet, is how do you create a support structure to figure out how to parse out the jobs that are available and do things like healthcare and all of that.
Yeah,
the guilds kind of.
There's a freelancers union in the States, but I don't think it's quite matured enough to do that. And certainly in Britain, it's like the National Union of Journalists would be the organization that people sign up to find some protection.
Well, let's get in one last question before we close up here.
I was wondering if you see concern in some of the stories that hit very, very big virally. For instance, the story about the Ugandan military renegade, Kony, which got 4 million hits in one day based on a report that was put out that appears to be inaccurate and perhaps for financial gain. And I think another example of that might be the anti-SOPA onslaught that was incredibly inaccurate and possibly put out for financial gain from the companies that were benefiting from it.
It's quite possibly the greatest danger we face from that kind of rapidly released story. And again, Shira's point about, you know, the advantages of sort of conventional mainstream is that you're checked, double-checked, triple-checked before anything gets out there. We live in a world where stuff gets out so quickly. There's an appetite for outrage. And we have the mechanics to deliver those kinds of stories very quickly and not check them. Yeah, I think it's one of the biggest dangers.
Yeah. I think we're running out of time, so I'll disagree with Mary on that. It always sounds better in an accent anyway. So.
Well, if you guys want to continue the discussion, we'll be in the hotel lobby at the bar. A well-deserved drink, and you should join us for that. And we'll probably tweet out where we're going next, so you can come and follow us there, too. It was great to have all of you. Thank you for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you. All of you, wonderful panelists. And we'll see you out there.
Thanks very much.